Blog Talk Radio.
Mode One.
I want to rock with you.
You are now listening to Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
The following internet radio show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
If there is one industry that is well known for its high percentage of divorces, it is the entertainment industry. Some would argue that the words Hollywood and long-lasting marriage borders on being an oxymoron. For example, in 2012, we saw the singer Seal and popular supermodel Heidi Klum in their marriage, Russell Brand and Katy Perry, Martin Lawrence and ex-wife Shamika, Stevie Wonder and his ex-wife, as well as movie superstar Tom Cruise and his former wife Katie Holmes. Just before the new year began, Ashton Kutcher filed for a divorce from his wife of a few years, actress Demi Moore. Why is maintaining a successful marriage so challenging among men and women who have successful careers in the entertainment industry? And who is it more challenging for, the men or the women? Tonight, I have invited a longtime friend of mine to join me on the show to discuss his thoughts and opinions on the challenges facing married men who work in the entertainment industry. He has been a comedian and comedy writer in the entertainment industry for 25 years, and most recently he was tapped to be a staff writer on BET's new television comedy, Real Husbands of Hollywood, starring Kevin Hart, Nick Cannon, Boris Kodjoe, Dwayne Martin, J.B. Smooth, and Robin Thicke. If you have some thoughts, opinions, or general comments about Hollywood marriages, or you just want to ask my guests some questions about BET's new comedy, Real Husbands of Hollywood, then by all means, please call into the show at 646-478-5710 and join the conversation as my good friend Roland Buddy Lewis takes time out of his very busy schedule in order to get upfront and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Is this A. Alan Roger Curry of Mode One fame? Oh my God.
You're really good at this.
I gotta ask you though. Do you feel that black men have some type of unwritten obligation to date and marry someone in a race? You do.
I think they do. I think white people should date white people. I think black people should date black people.
Now, how'd you come up with this idea to go to Italy with the women?
With the women, right. I just got so tired of hearing all my male friends talk about Brazil and how great Brazil is for them.
When I was growing up, I would go and hear about black women complaining about white women are stealing our men. Don't complain about your goods being stolen if you casually leave them on the front porch.
Have sex. Enjoy your life.
You know, men really want women to have standards. They really do. And I don't know how we got off of the mark there, but men do like classy women, and they want women to have standards.
I think you can be single and be very, very happy, and I think it's about taking the pressures off about being married.
I'm not saying that you should disrespect a woman. Never disrespect your woman, but the key is to not let her walk all over you.
Romantic love is very volatile. People don't realize it. And it is a drug. People don't realize it. Men and women do stupid things. Not all men, but sometimes you'll do something stupid.
I think it's a turn-on because just to see that person, just to enjoy themselves and just to watch them touching that person and making them feel good, I think that's kind of sexy, actually.
Yo, yo, Mode One. Gerard McClendon from Chicago Tonight and the McClendon Report. Right now you're listening to Upfront and Straightforward with my good friend Alan Roger Curry. Mode One. Let the women know, fellas, what you're really thinking. Ha ha! Alan Roger Curry.
The Real Husbands of Hollywood.
I know you out here getting it, man. I'm getting it. You getting it. We got it. Get it?
Very funny, Mr. Campbell.
Oh, all right, Mr. Parker.
Why is she looking at me like that? She asked for that.
It's not a game. This is real black stuff.
I don't even understand what that accent is.
Don't mess around with the wrong gang. So many gangsters.
Ain't nobody smacking me.
I don't care about the kids. I know you don't care about the kids. Don't you try walking in their shoes sometimes. Wear the damn same size.
This is the night.
The Real Husbands of Hollywood, only on BET.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. We're on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and I'm your host, Alan Roger Curry. And today is Thursday, January 17th of the new year. This is my second episode of the new calendar year, 2013. And tonight I'm looking forward to having a conversation and discussion with a gentleman who is actually a longtime friend of mine. We grew up in the same hometown of Gary, Indiana, and he has been working in the entertainment industry for about 25 years now. And he's primarily worked as a comedian. He's also worked as a behind-the-scenes comedy writer for a number of television shows and films. And tonight, what we're going to be discussing is, well, a few things. Number one, I'm going to be briefly discussing just different things related to his career. And then we're going to segue into talking about his new assignment, which he is a staff writer on a new BET comedy entitled Real Husbands of Hollywood. Real Husbands of Hollywood. It's an interesting show. It's supposed to be kind of a hybrid of a reality show and a scripted sitcom. And its first episode actually did receive rave reviews from a lot of critics. It earned a lot of viewership. It was actually the highest viewed show in its time slot. It beat out a lot of other, you know, the top network shows in its time slot. It premiered this past Tuesday, and it stars Kevin Hart, who is the main executive producer of the show. And again, it's entitled Real Husbands of Hollywood, and my guest tonight is one of the staff writers on that show. So we're going to be discussing that show, how that show came about. And then finally, I'm going to be asking my guests his thoughts and opinions on why is it so challenging to maintain a successful marriage in Hollywood? Why is it? Because I think it goes without question, as I said in my intro, that if there's one industry that's just frequently associated with divorces and short marriages, is the entertainment industry. I mean, if someone stays married more than 10 years and definitely more than 20 years in the entertainment industry, it's almost eyebrow raising, because so many couples get divorced. Some people don't stay married even a good 6 months in the entertainment industry, and other people are divorced within the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So that is another main topic of discussion. Speaking of topics of discussion, man, woo! Oh, the news reports are talking about, well, a few stories actually, but the main one is Notre Dame linebacker, and I hope I don't pronounce his name wrong, Monty Teo, he, you know, there was a big story going on the whole season that he lost his grandmother and he lost his girlfriend on the same day.
The story was that he lost his girlfriend to leukemia, and he was heartbroken about it, and that's what inspired him to go out and play his best every game. And a lot of the news media ate it up. Newspapers talked about the story. Magazines talked about the story. And we're talking about reputable newspapers and magazines talked about this story. Only to have Deadspin.com came out with a story yesterday that said that his supposed girlfriend never existed. She never existed. And they couldn't find a birth certificate for her. They couldn't find any Google hits for her. And supposedly one of Manti's friends has come forward and confessed that he created a bogus Twitter account and or Facebook account using some other woman's picture. But Manti says he talked to a woman on the phone for months. And so there's a lot. It's a really bizarre story. I think the key is he's now saying that he was the victim of a hoax, but a lot of people are accusing him of knowing that this was a hoax all along, knowing it was a lie. They saying, as my good friend and frat brother Dwayne Mitch used to say, don't live in a lie, don't live in a lie. They said he was living in a lie. They said Monty Tail was living in a lie. And I feel bad for the young dude. I really do, because there's some stories that come out on celebrities and people in the public eye that you know a few days later or a few weeks later or a few months later, it's going to subside and just go away and be forgotten about. Then there's other stories that come out to do with, you know, celebrities and people in the public eye that you know are going to last for a while, if not forever, at least for a few years. I put this story in the second category. I think 6 months from now, when somebody says the name Monty Tao, people are going to think about this story. I think 5 years from now, when somebody says the name Monty Tao, people are going to mention it, think about it, bring up this story. If he's a successful player in the NFL, people are going to talk about this. If he's an unsuccessful player in the NFL, people are going to talk about this. Do you know that surveys show that if there's one thing that people are more afraid of than death, it's public speaking? And guess what? The number one reason why people are afraid of public speaking more than death is because people are afraid of being embarrassed or humiliated in a public manner. That's people's biggest fear in life. So you can say that Monty Tao, he has just experienced most people's absolute biggest fear, which is public humiliation. Now, it's interesting because right before his story broke, the big story that kind of fell into the same category was Lance Armstrong. You could say he is the most publicly humiliated and disgraced athlete in recent years because he had to acknowledge that he was using performance-enhancing drugs. And for years, I was going to say for years he denied it, but he never really smoothly denied it. He just never would confirm. He would neither confirm or deny. He would just basically, you know, avoid the issue. But now he's coming out. I believe the interview is tonight with Oprah. It's being aired tonight on her network, where he acknowledges that he used performance-enhancing drugs. Man, what is up with athletes cheating, using drugs, and athletes getting caught in lies or being involved in hoaxes? Oh, my goodness, what is going on? But hey, I'm going to tell you. With this new age we're living in, the age, as I call it, the age of Twitter, the age of Facebook, the age of just internet and social media, Well, even before the age of social media, there was what's known as pen pals. I don't know if people are familiar with that, but there were a lot of people who hooked up by writing love letters to each other and becoming what was known as pen pals. There's even stories I've read where people got married within a week or two after they met each other in person because they spent months, if not years, just writing letters to each other. But anyway, what I was going to say is now in the age of social media, you got a lot of people who will connect with people online, on Twitter, Facebook, or on an online matchmaking site like Match.com, and they become smitten with members of the opposite gender, or in some cases, I guess, members of the same gender, when they haven't really met the person. You know, there's a term that's been thrown out now. It's called catfishing. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that term, but there's actually a term called catfishing. I'm gonna look up the term. Catfish, what does it mean to cat? Okay, catfish is, this is according to the Urban Dictionary. A catfish is someone who pretends to be someone who they're not while using Facebook, Twitter, or other social media. These people use false identities to pursue people of interest. So that is catfishing. It's basically anytime you're being deceptive and fraudulent online or via the internet, you are guilty of engaging in catfishing behavior. Catfishing behavior. So yeah, that's what's going on these days. A lot of people, I've had friends and acquaintances who, to one degree or another, even myself, I admit there's probably been one or two women that I carried on for days, weeks, or months over the phone before I met them in person. Let me take that back. I don't know if I've ever had anybody who deceived themselves as far as pretending to be a totally different person. I haven't experienced that, at least not that comes to mind. But what I've experienced is developing a strong rapport with a woman online prior to meeting them in person. But no, I don't think I've ever experienced a situation where someone was pretending, like, say, somebody told me their name was Linda Johnson or Deborah Williams, only for me to find out later that they were someone totally different. I don't think I've ever experienced that myself, but I know at least a handful of people who have experienced it. So anyway, I guess my advice, given this whole Monty Teo scenario, is watch yourself when you're trying to connect with people via the internet. You know, make sure you meet them in person soon after you connect with them on the internet. Don't spend, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year or longer just talking to somebody on through email or over the phone. Now meet that person and see if they are who they say they are. Kobe Bryant, who is playing LeBron's team tonight, the Lakers play the Miami Heat tonight on TNT. Kobe came out and said he would beat LeBron in a one-on-one contest. He said he would beat. He said, now here's his modesty coming out. Kobe Bryant said that he believes he is the best one-on-one player ever. Now, I'm sure Michael Jordan, among a few other NBA athletes, would probably say, okay, Kobe, I don't know how much crack you've been smoking, but... But yeah, I mean, I guess you got to give him props for having confidence in his abilities. He said he believes two things. Number one, he said he believes he would beat LeBron one-on-one because he thinks LeBron is more of a passer, more of a facilitator. And secondly, he said he believes he is the greatest one-on-one player of all time. I think my boy from Chicago right now, if he was healthy, I think Derrick Rose would take Kobe to the hoop. Now, I don't think Derrick Rose would be able to beat Kobe in his prime at the peak of his abilities. But if you're talking about right now, today, man, if Derrick Rose was healthy, I don't think Kobe Bryant could hang with Derrick Rose. That's my opinion. Anyway, I'm going to take an intermission break, and when I get back, I'm going to introduce my guest for tonight, and we're going to get our conversation going. So don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. I will be right back.
Can you feel the tension? You know what's coming up next, don't you? You all know what's coming up next. So what can I tell you? I'm excited. I'm standing backstage and I'm all jittery. It's the moment we've all been waiting for. What can I tell you? I read this guy's book about 2 years ago, and this is some of the most powerful shit I've read. The guy's mind-blowing. He's got a radio show. He's been all over the place. He's got crazy fans. He's amazing at what he does. He loves helping people as well. This guy will go on for hours and hours, even if it's like one person or 100 people. He doesn't give a shit. He'll stand there and he'll help people and help them and help them and just keep it. And he loves this stuff. He's passionate about it. He changed my life. He's changing everybody's life in the room and thousands of people, and he's amazing. I'm really happy. I consider him one of my mentors. I love the guy. Please go crazy for Alan Roger Curry.
And I need to know what you said to the Japanese girl on roller skates.
I went up to her. I said, you got a talent for this rollerblading thing. And that was probably the only moment when she was smiling. She was like, yes, I love to rollerblade. I said, well, to be quite frank with you, I didn't give a fuck about rollerblading. I said, your ass looks so juicy in that, what is that, spandex? And she was like, oh, my God, I mean, would you just come to Venice Beach to just look at women's asses? I was like, is that a trick question?
Please visit www.mode1.net for more information on the Direct Approach Dating Summit 2010 DVD. Are you an expert and/or book author who offers men and women products and services related to dating and relationships? If you have a new product, a valuable service, or upcoming event or speaking presentation that you would like to advertise on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network that is guaranteed to hit your target demographic audience, then look no further than Blog Talk Radio's number one talk radio podcast program for active dating singles. Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry has had more episodes ranked number one in the category of romance, dating and relationships, love and sex, and overall self-help for singles than any other talk radio podcast program on the entire Blog Talk Radio network since January of 2008. I will help you advertise any product, service, or event that is designed to help men and women improve their love lives, sex lives, and overall social lives. Please write me at Blog Talk Radio Advertising at mode1.net. That's MODEONE.net. Don't wait. Do it now.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here
on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. We now return to Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Welcome back to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, the most listened to talk radio podcast program on the Blog Talk Radio Network in the category of romance and dating and relationships. I have to give my few shout-outs that I forgot to give to my all my listeners. I love all my listeners, but particularly my live listeners, my chat room listeners. I see Diva362636 in the chat room. That's my number one most loyal listener, and she's multitasking as she normally does on Thursday because she loves Scandal. She's probably watching Lance Armstrong on Oprah. She's going to be watching the Miami Heat at the Lakers, but she's, you know, stopped in to listen to my show tonight. I see my friend Nelson in the chat room, a few other guests. I'm sure I have some other people coming in the chat room a little later. Also, shout-outs will be my older brother and ace confidant, Stephen Curry. Stephen Curry, good friend, Irvin V. Pulliam, match one from Seattle. All my younger cousins in Chicago, Maplewood, New Jersey, Detroit, you know who you are. My guest tonight, I've known him since I was in grade school. He and I both grew up in Gary, Indiana, and he later on attended Howard University and went on to have a successful career in the entertainment industry. He's been working in the entertainment industry now for, I'd say, roughly about 25 years. Some people just give it up. They say, hey, man, I tried the entertainment industry for 5 years, and I'm going to work at the car wash, or, you know, I'm going to go back and be the district manager of Burger Daddy. But, no, he's been working for 25 years, primarily as a comedian. He's appeared on Def Comedy Jam, among other television venues. He's worked probably every club in the Los Angeles area, in addition to a number of other cities across the country. And in addition to being a well-known comedian, he is also a behind-the-scenes comedy writer. He has written for a number of television shows, a number of TV shows. He's written for Jamie Foxx show. He's written for the BET Awards, the Essence Awards. He's written for Tyler Perry's House of Pain. He's written for the ESPY Awards. He's written for the Vibe Awards. He's acted both on stage. Not only has he done television and film, but he's done stage acting, which he's won a lot of accolades and awards for. He was seen in Black Dynamite, Big Stan, The Brothers, Wu. You remember Wu with Will Smith's wife. And just his resume is honestly too extensive for me to cover in this intro. But I just am glad to have him as a guest tonight. He's been holding it down, and I'm very proud of him. So listeners, on behalf of the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and Upfront and Straightforward, give it up for Mr. Roland Buddy Lewis.
Man, if you had gone on any longer with that intro, I was going to say, who is that Negro? I'd like to meet him myself.
Hey, brother, man.
The funny thing is, Alan, is you go, who is that dude? You got all these accolades. Well, I don't know who he is. That's the most humbling thing in the world. You go through all of that, and it's like every one of your listeners is going, I don't know that Negro.
Yeah, that's the thing. The the fame game. I remember, God, I can't remember who it was now who said, but some celebrity one time, he had started to get, you know, a lot of roles, and he said, it's interesting. He said, it took me 20 years to become an overnight celebrity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think you worked in the business long enough to know that there's probably a lot of people who worked in the entertainment industry for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, but they might not be a household name, or at least not just yet.
Mm-hmm. A couple of our friends, we call them anonymous. They're the people you see every time, they're character actors. You go, oh, man, that's the dude from South. Oh, that's the dude. And it's the same guy. So I'm like anonymous. I work a little bit, but I'm not quite a household name. As a matter of fact, everyone in my own house don't know me. Like, who is that dude walking around here in his drawers? I wish he'd do something. But, that's the nature of the entertainment game, is that you can operate and move and be part of the system and not be known, internationally or nationally as a celebrity, but you work. And I'm one of those people that works. I don't have the fame that matches my work, but that's also a good thing too, in a way that I'm proud that I continue to work, and I'm happy and I'm blessed that I continue to work and I get jobs, and then I keep parlaying a job that I have to the next one. But I can leave my house. You know, there are a lot of people, when you get a lot of fame, there's some people where you can't go anywhere, and you're stuck in your own house, and you're stuck, behind the walls, and you become isolated, and you lose sight of what you've done and what you can do when you're that famous that you can't even, you can't even go outside. You know, and that to me is a problem. I like going to Target. As a matter of fact, I'm a big time hunter. As a matter of fact, I started hunting. I started hunting in Costco, and I can tell you, I don't need I don't need a gun in there. You just hunt for everything and food. And they got stuff you don't even know you need. They got draws in the 1,000 pack. You can just get whatever you want in Costco. So.
But, I was just in Costco, this 2 weekends ago?
Mm-hmm.
And, man, they got everything in Costco, man.
Everything. Love it. And snacks. You can go in there and get your dinner on. Your little samples. I will sample my ass. They look at me like, okay, so the one snack per person is too much. You're killing them samples. That's like they call me Sample. When I come in, they show my little card. Here comes Sample with extras.
Oh, you silly. Oh, my goodness. Now, and that's why I give you props, man. As you were saying, you've been working because, man, I know you know because I know so many people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I honestly say include myself a lot of times. Who their level of motivation and ambition was high for maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years. But then because they had such a hard time, getting consistent work, they was like, oh, man, forget this, man. I'm going back to pharmaceutical sales. I'm going back to this. I'm going back to that. What do you think has been the key to your longevity in this business?
Two things. One, my dogged determination, and secondly, my failing grades in college. You got to, you can't go nowhere with a full credit B in physics. That's just not going to do it. You can't talk about going to med school with that full credit D. I'm like, I think for me, man, really, it's there are two things I think that have helped me. One, I'm blessed. I'm truly, truly blessed. and that I've met some people that who have come up in the game and who continue to hire me. And secondly, I'm very, very, very determined. I'm one of those kind of people that's almost OCD with, you're not going to stop me from doing what I got to do. If I say I put my mind to something, I'm going to do it. And so I think those are the two biggest things. And you got to be persistent, and you got to sort of have a game plan. And I think my game plan when I first got out here was a little different. Well, not necessarily different, but I had the desire, but I didn't really know what I was doing. And that's a problem with a lot of people that come to L.A. or go to New York when they start off trying to get into the entertainment game. They don't really have a plan. And I didn't have one either. I just finished school. And as a matter of fact, man, you know who got me out here? Our girl, Kim Patterson, was working at Capitol Records. And she invited me out and said, come out and hang with me for a weekend or two. And I came out and I stayed.
I remember when you left.
Yeah, and I stayed. And I went home after I got out of school. I had been fired from my last job. And I said, I got fired on Easter. I got fired on Good Friday. That's how I knew it was time for me to go. I got fired. And listen, this is after I got the promotion. This is what's so crazy. I got fired after getting the promotion. I got fired on Good Friday. And I went home for about 6 months, saved up some money. I substitute taught in Gary. And I realized, you know what, I need to get out of here before I kill one of these little kids, because I don't like little kids in school. They're really bad and rambunctious and terrible. And so I said, I'll get out of here. If I don't get out of here soon, one of these little kids is going to catch a case. And I ended up coming out here. Kimberly Patterson was working at Capitol Records, and her boyfriend at the time was managing Freddie Jackson. Freddie Jackson and Alex Bunyan, the jazz player. His name is Kevin Harewood, and he got me some work. And I got out here at the like I said, I'm blessed. I got out here at the beginning height of the Robin Harris era down at the Comedy Act Theater, and the explosion sort of urban comedy in L.A. And so it was sort of a blessing and sort of a miracle all at the same time that I came out here and just caught on that wave, and I've been riding it ever since then.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned Robin Harris and the Comedy Act Theater. I was checking out your website,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
You say something on that website that I was like, okay, I don't know if Buddy is being funny or he's being serious or a little bit of both. But I'm going to read it. Since you got it on a website, I guess I can go ahead and read it. You say, I started my career in L.A. at the Comedy Act Theater where the late Robin Harris. And for my listeners, if that name gets loosely sounds familiar, but you're like, man, I can't play. Robin Harris was best known. He had one bit that he was primarily known for, and that was Bebe's Kids. He would talk about these bad kids. So in case listeners,
the movies he did prior to him dying, which were House Party, the first original House Party, Mo Better Blues, Do the Right Thing. He was one of the old guys that was, you know, the two street guys that were talking about the Korean guy on the street. So he did some good work before he passed. But, yeah, and his HBO special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, matter of fact, yeah, it's funny you bring that up because it was interesting. He passed. I'll never forget this day. He passed away right after he filmed
HBO special in Chicago and passed in his sleep. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, get back to your comments, though. You say, mm-hmm, I started my career in L.A. at the Comedy Act Theater, where the late Robin Harris became famous for hosting that club. He accused me of stealing his joke about buying Kotex in the store for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, he had this joke about super dupers. You know, I went to the store and got some super dupers. And they announced on the microphone, buying super dupers. You know how women would send you to the store to buy Kotex. And I did something very similar. And he accused me of stealing his joke. And I went, man, I didn't steal your joke. I said, I don't know if you wrote the movie Mr. Mom, but that's where I stole it from. I didn't steal from you.
You're like, I stole it, but I didn't steal it from you.
Yeah, I didn't steal from you. I stole from the movie Mr. Mom. Did you write Mr. Mom? Because that's where I stole it from. But what ended up happening was I told him that, you know, my intention was not to – I had never seen him do that joke. And I learned that day that material is precious. And there is a fine line between – well, actually, it's not fine. It's a very, very thick line between talking about a particular subject in – you know, two comics can talk about the same subject, but it's another thing to take a premise and almost verbatim do someone else's material. And that's the fine line you got to watch as a comic. You know, you have to learn. And that's what I also learned, that I want to be a person that has his own original material and not try to bite other people's material. I've been one of those kind of people. If I see somebody do something that I think is a premise that I came up with, and somebody does something similar, I'll stop doing it. Or
wow.
Because I believe I'm good enough to come up with new stuff. But if it's something that I do, and it's like a young comic or something, like, yo man, you gotta. I don't know where you got that from, and I'm not saying you stole it from me, but I'm telling you now, that's what I do. So if I ever see you in a club and you're in a club and I know you're going to do that, I'm going to insist that I go up before you. And
wow.
You won't be able to do your material. And that's why a lot of comics, you know, will try to jump the bone. They walk into a club, nah, man, put me up before this dude. And so what you do is you ruin them because they ain't got nowhere to go. So,
yeah.
But I pride myself in trying to keep coming up with new material and write my own stuff so that I'm not accused of or being a guy that is a person that has a reputation for borrowing concepts or ideas or premises. And I think part of being a good comic and moving to the level of great comic is coming up with premises or working with people who can help you develop and come up with material that is your own. And that's what takes so long for a lot of comics in this business, to come up with a beat or just a vibe or whatever it is, your point of view that makes your material almost impossible to steal.
Mm-hmm.
And there are guys that get to that level, like Chris Rock. You can't really steal Chris Rock's material because it's the way he delivers things. You can try and say it, but somebody will go, "Oh man, that's Chris Rock's joke." So you got to be able to, even if it's a storytelling comic, like let's say Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle tells great stories. Kevin Hart now tells great stories. You with little catchphrases and all that kind of stuff. So you got to be able to manipulate and mold your point of view so that even when people see it, you'll go, ah, man, he's doing Kevin Hart or he's doing Martin Lawrence. And so you got to make sure that that's what you do as a comic. And that's what I try to pride myself in, that I'm my own person. People know, okay, that's Buddy's beat. That's my vibe. That's my lane. And I wish I had done it a little bit more seriously earlier in my career, but, you know, the business has sort of changed a little bit for comedy as a whole. But I think my point of view is where it is now, and it's better now because I just spent so much time on stage.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, it was, two things. One, along the lines of what you're talking about. I remember years ago, I was reading this article about, they said more than any other aspect of the entertainment industry, they were saying that in general, theft is kind of known, like screenwriters steal from other screenwriters and directors steal styles from other directors. But they said most notably is comedy. And they highlighted names. I can't remember all of them. But they were highlighting names of top comics who have gotten into literally fist fights. Like, I'll give a couple of names. They said Sam Kinison, the late Sam Kinison, I should say. He passed away. They said he, like, attacked some other comic for stealing his stuff.
Oh, no, dude. I can name names. Carlos Mencia has been accused. Arnaz J. The list goes on and on. I saw Joe Torre beat a guy up in front of a club. I almost accosted a dude over it. It's just because the problem with the comedy game is this. It's who can present the material first. And it's very difficult when you're a struggling up-and-coming comic. You come up with a premise that's great. You come up with a premise that could get you on Tonight Show, get you on Letterman, get you to the next level, and then some famous comic comes in and robs you. And then goes on Letterman and does your stuff. You're like, that's my joke. You know, and now you spent ten years finally getting to act. And now Carlos Mencia, Arnaz J., Bruce, I don't care who it is. And I'm not saying these guys all steal, but I'm just saying Earthquake, whoever goes on a show, does your material. You're screwed. DL, it don't matter. Jamie Foxx, it don't matter. You're like, I can't do that joke anymore. And so it sort of sets you back, and you get angry and you're bitter because you're like, it makes you a little bitter because it's like, here I am struggling to pay my rent. And this guy's making $50,000 per night on a show, and he's doing my stuff. Well, shit, if you want to do my material, why don't you pay me to write for your ass?
There you go. There you go.
If you're going to keep stealing from me, dude, you know, I heard, I don't know if it was Damon or somebody said that. He said that to somebody. It was somebody. He's like, yo, my buddy, you just want to keep stealing my material. Why don't you just pay me to write?
Matter of fact, speaking of Damon, I never forget, for my listeners, most of you know, I did comedy briefly back in the day, and I was a judge for a contest that Damon was hosting. I don't know if I've ever seen this. Maybe you have with your career.
Uh-huh.
But it's wild. It's one thing to see comics steal somebody's stuff and the person they're stealing from, say, is not present. But it's another thing to see somebody, if you were in a club and say you saw somebody doing Eddie Murphy stuff and Eddie Murphy's in the club. And Dave, that's what happened with Dave. We were a guy in a contest. I don't know what this guy was thinking.
He did some of
Damon Wayans stuff, and Damon Wayans was the host of the contest. And Damon came out. It was really an awkward moment because Damon was so pissed, and I didn't blame him. But he came out when the guy was performing. He told the audience, he said, this nigga's stealing my shit. And the whole audience started looking. They was like laughing, and at the same time, looking at each other like, damn, is this part of that skit or is he being serious? But yeah, the dude was doing, he wasn't doing none of his recent stuff. He was doing like Damon stuff from, say, 5 years prior.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, I vaguely remember that story. I vaguely remember that story about that, and I think was that the Bay Area comedy competition? I think.
No, this was in Chicago. This was actually they used to have. I don't think they have it anymore. The big contest they had in Chicago, which now I have to lightheartedly toot my little horn. They Miller Lite beer had
Miller Lite,
comedy search contests in different cities.
That's right. I remember that.
They had them in different cities, and they had it in Chicago. And I won the contest in 89.
Right.
And then the next year, 1990, Bernie Mac won in 1990. And that, it was his contest. It was the contest the night Bernie Mac won. I was a judge. And, yeah, this guy who didn't place, he didn't do very long. It wasn't like he did it like 20 minutes. He probably did maybe like 5 to 7 minutes of Damon's stuff. Mm-hmm. But, of course, Damon knew his stuff. And, yeah, Damon came out on stage and was like, I do not believe this shit. He said, this nigga's doing my shit. And all the comics there, like me, anybody who was a fan of comedy immediately knew the guy was doing Damon's stuff.
Right.
Because it goes back to what you said. It's like when you most comics, the good ones, they get to a point where they have kind of their what I call their signature material.
Right.
And now my final thing on this issue, one very well-known comic that going back to this article I read, who they said was notorious, kind of surprising for some people, they said was Robin Williams. They said a lot of comics used to be pissed at Robin Williams because they said he would do just what you talked about. He would listen to guys who were up and coming, and then he would go on, like, say, the Tonight Show and do their shit.
And he was a great mimic. So he would take your material and flip it and change it around just to take out a verb and add an adjective here. And the next thing you know, your bit is gone like the wind.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of those people that had that reputation. Yeah, and because he was so talented, it really made it weird because he was such a improvising, you know, I mean, Robin could pull out stuff out of his butt everywhere and do a joke and flip it and change it. And it didn't make sense for him to steal. But, you know, I think part of that whole era at that time, you got to remember, man, a lot of comics, man, at that time and age, they didn't know where they heard stuff and what they did with material. They don't know where it came from. Because half of them was high as a kite anyway, so they didn't know where they got the material from. They don't even know.
Their drug use
was so expensive that they're like, man, I came up with this at my house. I'm like, fool, you ain't been at your house in 3 days. You meth fiend. You heroin head. You don't know where you've been the last 3 days.
Man,
I got a lot of old school comic friends that tell me how that was like back in the early 80s and, you know, late 70s. Shoot, if you were a comic and didn't do drugs, you were not a part of the scene.
Wow, that's a strong statement.
That's the truth.
Wow.
And a lot of these guys are recovering alcoholics, cocaine heads, and they're recovering. You probably don't know it, but some of them they got lucky and kicked the habit, but a lot of them is just straight up just they were fiends of the program.
Wow.
You'd be shocked.
Now, you being from GI, for those listeners who don't know GI, Gary, Indiana, I know Mike Epps is from Indianapolis. Is there any other well-known comic other than you and Mike Epps that's from Indiana that you know of?
David Letterman is from...
Oh, that's right, David Letterman. He sure is from... He's from, I think, Indianapolis.
There's another comic, Herman Hurston is in Virginia. It's from Gary. I know I'm leaving some people out. But I think there's one or two young guys out here that are from Indiana and from Gary. There's a couple of guys, and they'd be mad if they heard this and go, buddy, man, come on, you know me. And I'm like, yeah, I forget, but I'm forgetting. But yes, there are a couple of females. There's one girl I met that was from Gary that's in the comedy game.
And then there are a couple of guys, and they're younger than me, so I don't know them personally. You know, I see them in the clubs, and I run across them from time to time, but we're not like running buddies. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Man, I remember when I came out for a visit to L.A. This was in spring of 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, my man here, Buddy Lewis, took me to this club. Man, it was like a miniature Def Jam All-Star. It was like people there that hadn't blown up yet, but it was just wild. I mean, for you, I guess that was like kind of a every week or every month thing. But for me, man, I ain't going to lie, man. I don't know if I told you the time. I was kind of tripping, man, because you was just like very casual. You was like, hey, Alan, man, why don't you meet me at this club? We'll hang out, have a good time. I'm like, okay. And you go to this club, and man, it must have been at least 10 to 15. Well, for those younger, y'all might not remember Def Comedy Jam, but in my generation, that was pretty popular in the early to mid-90s. And
right.
Like, for example, you introduced me to Chris Tucker that night.
Yeah.
But that was before
he did
Rush Hour and any of that.
Yeah. Where were we? I'm trying to remember where we were.
It was downtown L.A. I cannot remember the name, though. I know it was downtown L.A.
It wasn't improv, was it?
No, it wasn't a comedy club. It was like a nightclub. It was like a dance. It was a nightclub.
Man. Birdland?
That might have been it. Think of where you used to go to in 94.
This was probably Long Beach. We were probably, if we weren't at Birdland, we were over at the Supper Club, which is right over, were we by CBS Studios?
I think so.
That was a club they used to have right across the street from CBS Studios, and I used to go in there because at the time I think I was working on Vibe. And was I working on Vibe? I think you were out here when I was working on Vibe, and they didn't use any of my jokes. So I used to take my jokes that they didn't take and submit to the. For the show, I go in there and do them on stage. And people are like, why don't they do this stuff on the show? And I'm like, I turned it in, but they don't do it.
Oh man,
fired from that job too, so it don't matter.
Now,
me and my boy, the host, got fired.
Moving from being a I'm gonna take an intermission break, but when I come back, I want to transition from your career as a on stage comedian to a comedy writer, and then more specifically, I want to ask you some questions about the show you're working on now, which got rave reviews on its Tuesday's premiere, which was The Real Husbands of Hollywood. But listeners, I'm going to take a brief break. So I will be back in about 3 to 4 minutes. I'm going to let Buddy get a swig of water, and then I will be back. So don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
You're about to enter into the erotic zone with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, the king of verbal seduction. This is the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Diana DeVoe, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Layla Odom, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Bella.
And this is Charlie.
And we're dancers from the legendary Scores Strip Club in New York City. And you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Alexandra Cunahakis, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
So I'm getting treated for my sex disease.
This is Nikki True, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Ambrosia Cumming, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Vocal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Brandy L. Davis, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
Episodes of the Erotic Conversationalist are available as a downloadable MP3 file from www.mode1.net.
All right, I'm going to go with my next caller, area code 310. You are now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. What's your question or comment?
I used to date lots of women, both in high school and in college and in medical school, and people used to always ask me, you're not the best looking guy, you're not the richest guy out there, how are you getting all these women? And essentially the answer is actually quite simple. It's essentially having the confidence and knowing what you want to do.
Oh, thank you, Master Allen.
Ooh, say that again.
Yes, Master Allen.
Oh, say that again.
Yes, sir, Master Allen.
I like that.
Hey, buddy, thank you so much for having me. That is easily the nicest introduction that I've ever had.
What's going on, fellas?
Thanks for tuning in. It's nice to see you all again, so.
If you found this page, I'm guessing at least on some level you'd like more success.
Seducing sexy ladies. Here's the deal.
My name's Sasha. Hello. And I like women.
Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody.
This website has tons of resources to help you guys get that success that you want. It's all there for you. The articles, the videos, my blog with lots of adventures and tips, it's all there for you guys.
Let's make the magic happen.
If you're interested in some more intense training, take one of my boot camps. They are fucking good. I'll be honest with you guys. I'm doing boot camps all around the world, so I might be coming to your city.
I would love to come over there and teach you this stuff because it's awesome! And you learn how to meet tons of hot girls. If you're in London, this is the guy. He's going to take good care of you. He's really present in the moment. He's really good. He hooks up with tons of girls. Good teacher and just somebody you want to hang out with and learn from. Oh, so many names.
It's my first name and my sister name.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, I will see you.
You will?
Soon. Ryan.
Ryan. Me too.
Over the last few years, I've dedicated my life to getting good in a sort of fun and natural way of meeting women in the daytime.
What are you doing, actually, in your free time? What's your goal?
I meet beautiful girls on the streets. You know, chat girls on the street. Sound test? Sound test 1, 2, 3, 4. Sexy man. Hi. Can I get a little fist action? We're filming. I just want a little fist. Just come on. You know you want to. You know you want to fist me right now. Boom shakalaka.
Yeah, check out the bootcamp page if you're interested in that.
I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it's useful to you. So please.
Sasha at sashapway.com. Thanks for coming to the site and...
Stop being a fucking... Just... What? I mean, come on, people. She's there in front of you. That's the only indicator of interest you need. She's there. You're there. Go for it.
Please pay a visit to www.sashapua.com.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Yeah.
have me check on them.
The Real Husbands of Hollywood, only on BET.
We now return to my discussion about the challenge of maintaining a successful marriage while working in the entertainment industry with Roland Buddy Lewis on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network.
Curry, the most listened to talk radio podcast program on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network in the category of romance, dating, and relationships. This episode, similar to last week's episode, we've kind of gotten away from dating relationships, but at the same time, we got one foot into it as this upcoming segment, I'm going to be asking questions. If you're just tuning in, my guest tonight is a longtime friend of mine, and he's also a person who's been a comedian and a comedy writer. He's worked in the entertainment industry for about 20, 25 years, and his name is Roland Buddy Lewis, and his most recent comedy writing assignment is on BET's new hit show entitled Real Husbands of Hollywood. Now, I would assume, based on your resume, buddy, you've done quite a bit of work over the years as a comedy writer.
Yeah, I like I said, man, that comes mostly from relationship and being around guys who have eventually have had major success. They bring you with them. I've written for Ken Whitley. I wrote for DL. I wrote for some of the hosts on Def Jam. I wrote for Chris Spencer when he was on Vibe. I wrote an episode of Tyler Perry's House of Pain. I've written for a lot of different comics and for a lot of different shows. So I've been fortunate. Doug Williams on First Amendment. So I've been pretty fortunate to have not only been able to work, but establish relationships with all those comics.
Now take me into the mind of a comedy writer. Well, first of all, yeah, I remember when you wrote for Vibe, because there was one or two skits that Chris Spencer had at the beginning of the show that I remember yelling at the TV, and my friends were like, "Why are you yelling at the TV?" I said, "That's Buddy, that's Buddy." And yeah, he had you in his skit. But that's one thing to go on stage and you're getting that immediate feedback from whatever you say. Mm-hmm. But when you're writing for television, I would think that's a little more challenging. Let me ask you, how do you know if what you're writing is going to, you know, get the laughs that you want it to get?
Well, it's not, you don't know sometimes, you don't know, but you know if you're writing good stuff, you keep getting a job. That's how you get decent stuff, because somebody hires you again. But for the most part, the thing you got to sort of give up when you're writing for other people is the immediate gratification, you know, because it's not there. You're not hearing clapping. You're not hearing people scream for you. You've got to let whoever you've given that material to throw it out there, and they're getting it back. If they're getting it back, they're confident, and you're confident that whatever you put out there has been good, and you sort of gauge it by what's the reaction you're getting from the people watching whatever it is, whatever material you wrote. And so, like, for example, Jamie Foxx when he hosted the ESPYs. I wrote for him for 2 years. Well, that song that he wrote, "Let Me Be Your Tennis Ball," when he's talking to Venus, I helped write that song. So it was one of the big things of the night. So I felt like I had contributed, and it's one of those things where you go, I helped write that, and you get it. You get it later when people say, "Oh man, so and so did so and so," and you go, "Yeah, I helped write that." So that's the sort of thing you get, but it sometimes comes later, and it comes in the form of your resume. You know, you get it when somebody goes, "Oh, you wrote on blank and blank," and you're like, "Yes, I contributed material to that," and they're like, "Oh, that was so funny," and you go, "Yes, I was a part of that," and that's what makes you get what you need from when it comes to self gratification from it all. But some of that is given up when you're a writer. You just don't get it until you're Larry David or something, and people know you're famous for writing material. Bruce Valanche, you know, some of those guys are just famous for writing.
Okay. Now, you mentioned, we were talking about Chris. I remember when you wrote on Vibe, you two mm-hmm. seem to have a really good friendship. Is he one of your closer friends in the business?
Oh yeah, I think I can say this probably without a doubt. He's probably my best friend in the business, and we sort of made a pact when we were working, because Chris came up a little behind me, and we were both working on this play called Grease Fried and Laid to the Side, and we said that we did our little pinky, you know, blood pact that whoever made it first would help the other one out, and Chris got there a little before me, and so he's subsequently hired me just about on every job where he can hire somebody. He's hired me and or got me a job, and so he's to this very day when we worked on the BET Awards, and we wrote the first he created, and then we helped write the first two episodes of The Real Husbands of Hollywood that was on, I think, the 2010 and 2011 BET Awards, or 2011 and 12, and subsequently we got a show. So, this is the funny Chris Spencer story. I have told this story. Chris was on Vibe, and we were writing, and I used to write material, and the head writer would, like, not take my material, and you know, sometimes he wouldn't, you know, they look at my jokes and go, "I don't get that." But I would take those same jokes that they didn't accept or didn't want in the packet or didn't. Chris didn't always see it because he'd come to the club and say, "Where's this material you're doing now? Because I'm reading it verbatim off of the page." And he's like, "Where was this?" I'm like, "They don't turn this shit into you. You don't get this." I don't know why, but I used to do it every week. I would keep all my material that I wrote, and I would do all the jokes at a club on Thursday and Friday. I'd go, like, across the street. But, you know, it was a strange thing over there, Vibe, man. It was, you know, Chris had come in sort of after Arsenio, and, you know, they were trying to make him this Arsenio sort of, you know, all the people that worked on the show were Arsenio kind of people. They were, you know, his production staff and a lot of the people that produced that show. And so they didn't let Chris do what Chris does. And, you know, they were trying to mold and make it, "Oh, you need to be more like Arsenio." And it was, and I think Chris was young in the game. That show was really, really weird, you know, and it was like, and it is funny, man, when they're always African-American hosts or stars of a show, it's sometimes very odd that the entire writing staff and production staff will be all of these white guys, and they'll, like, one time the guy said, this is a true story, I told him, I said, "Man, we're writing all this material for Chris, and Chris is my friend. I'm like, we're writing all this material for Chris. Why don't we do like Jay Leno does, take the material and go across the street and let him pick what he wants to do, you know, and y'all can see what Chris does." The white guy actually told me, he said, man, Chris needs to tell the jokes we write. I went, oh, snap. It was like that.
Wow. Wow.
And they used to get mad at me because Chris would ask me, man, what do you think? I'm like, and I tell him the truth. I'd be like, man, you know, this stuff is whack. But so I guess one day the head writer got a hold of, you know, I found out I sort of told Chris. He's like, nah, man, I don't really like this, but Chris was my friend. So I'm not going to lie to him and tell him, oh, man, it's great. You go out there and you're looking crazy. So I tell him the truth. I was like, man, I don't like that. I don't like that. And he's like, he took my advice sometimes, and he'd tell them, no, I don't like this. I don't want that. I don't like this. So the head writer used to come in after they had picked all these jokes. And he told me one time, he said, yo, man, listen, you don't like something and you don't want something, don't be buzzing in Chris's ear. And I went, what? I went, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. I said, Chris is my friend. If he asks me, I'm going to tell him the truth, whether you like it or not. I'm going to inform him what I think because he is my friend. I said, you really didn't hire me. I feel like Chris hired me, and he hired me to tell him the truth. Now, if you don't like that, what you need to do is you need to talk with Chris and tell him, don't ask me what I think. that ended up working to my disadvantage because I was fired about 2 weeks before Chris.
Hey, but I like that integrity you displayed, man.
It did serve me well because the greatest story was we were in a meeting and we had written this bit called Chris Gets a Posse. And it was a bit that every black celebrity, once they get a celebrity, they by force have to get a posse. So like the posse team or crew comes by and says, all right, Chris, it's time for you to pick your posse. You need a DJ, you need a security guard, you need some bimbos. He got the pick, but it was like they brought a brochure and it was like a posse thing. And one of the producers on the show was like, I don't get this. I don't understand why this was funny. And he goes, back when I was doing Jack Parr, and we went, Jack Parr? Man, are you talking about a show that went off the air 50 years ago? What are you talking about? You can't, man. So I in the meeting, I said, well, you know, I said, you know, my thing is, you know, we have a demographic on the show, and I personally believe that we're trying to hit that demographic with the material and with the stuff we do. Maybe if being a guy who's over, you know, I said you're a 50 plus male, maybe you're not in the demographic that we're trying to hit, and so maybe there'll be times when we write things that you don't quite get. But this is really, really funny. And he was like, I appreciate the sentiment. And when I tell you, man, all of the white writers got up away from me like I had the plague. Well, you ever seen the Three Stooges when they went, whoever wants to do a step forward, and everybody steps back, and one dude is standing out there by himself? That was me. I was like, oh, man, I'm on my way. I was like this. I think I smell a dismissal. Wow, I am smelling fire, and I think what's on fire is my ass. I sure did. I got fired. I'm calling Chris going, yo, man, what's going on? He's like, buddy, I think I'm getting fired. That show was a mess, man. But I learned a valuable lesson. I learned that sometimes, as in a lot of places in Hollywood, the truth is not what people really want to hear. You know, the lie is the truth out here, and the truth is the lie. And so you've got to learn how to diplomatically maneuver and say things in a way that doesn't offend, but makes your point that you're confident about what you're saying, but you want to give the best, you want to put your best foot forward, but you got to learn how to temper that and say that with a certain amount of the best way I can say, with some je ne sais quoi, so that it's not like you're just blurting out stuff and you're offending people. But you know, it's hard to do. it's hard to do because sometimes this is just it's the it's right in your face where you go, man, that's some bullshit. You know, I don't like it. Or, you know, that's I'm not buying that. No, that's terrible. You just can't say that because sometimes you end up the people you offend or the people you hurt end up, there's a lot of cyclic movement in Hollywood. So the person you're putting down right now ends up becoming a network head. You're never going to get a job. You know, the PA you're offending might end up becoming the head of an agency. You're not going to be hired. So you got to be real careful and learn how to say things with diplomacy. But one thing you end up doing, though, when you speak the truth, is people will eventually respect you for your opinion. You know, when you can talk to the people that speaks the truth with temperament end up getting ahead. It's the truth. There are some habitual liars out here, but you will eventually rise up when you speak the truth with temperament. Because even when you say things that hurt people's feelings, if you say, hey man, you know what, that's not, and everybody misses. You know, there are some people that miss. There are some things that you say and you go, I was wrong about that. But, you know, because there are a lot of movies, TV shows, songs, plays that somebody said was some absolute garbage that ended up being the best thing ever made or ends up winning, somebody ends up winning something or getting an accolade that you go, man, I thought that was some crap. Yeah, you did, but you were wrong. You know, I can't tell how many TV shows somebody turned down a role on a show. Somebody turned down buying a piece or a production, had an opportunity to buy some show and turned it down at first. And it ends up being a hit. That happens often out here. But you got to do what you got to say what you feel at the time. And so that's why I'm so proud of this show now, because we threw it out there and it's really, really, really becoming a big thing. And there were a lot of people last year that didn't want to do the show, you know, because it's BET, because it's an urban show, because they got a whole bunch of stuff they didn't want to do it. And now when I tell you we've gotten people that are all clamoring now to do the show, man, you think you can find me something? No. You should have done it last year when we asked your black behind. No. We're not going to have anything for you. But, you know, I'm real proud of this.
That it's like that sounds really surprised me, but doesn't surprise. I guess I know the nature, of people, and they think something's not going to be a hit and it's not going to work, and then all of a sudden when they see it working, they're like, oh man. So wow. Now how did the I know this show, okay, I want to say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's the concept for this show started as these bits that were shown during the BET Awards.
Yeah, it was a sketch that was on the BET Awards. We did it was 2011 and 2012, we did. The first one was Kevin Hart, and it was Nelly and Bobby Brown and Anthony Anderson. There was a few people in that sketch. And then the following year, we did one with Samuel L. Jackson, and he cut off Kevin's hand. It escalated and it grew. And after we got such a good response, the BET networks said, listen, you know, I think, you know, we can – there is a show in here, and the idea was to spoof and to satire all of these other shows, and there were really no shows about men. You know, there was no basketball husbands. There was no, you know, there's no equivalent sort of, except the real crazy stuff, like, you know, the real, you know, where they have guns and pawn wars and all that kind of stuff. There's no real relationship-based kind of thing for men. There really wasn't. So how do we fix that? The idea is to put guys together that have relationships that everyone sort of knows and make a satirical spoof of everything else that you see out here as a reality show. And that's what we did. And so We took some guys that, I mean, and when I tell you the guys on this show are phenomenal. Kevin Hart is a true, and I don't want to bite my tongue when I tell you how talented this guy is. He's a young guy and he's phenomenally talented as an improv actor, as a quick witted talent. Man, after everything, his beats are, he's right on time sometimes, man, with stuff. And so he's a phenomenal talent. And that makes it easy to write for him. And you got J.B. Smoove, you got Boris Kojo, Robin Thicke, Dwayne Martin, Nick Cannon. All of these guys work together. We had Faison Love. So J.B. Smoove, man, when I tell you J.B. Smoove is one of the funniest guys I've ever seen in my life, I mean, just funny. And so the chemistry of all these guys working together is what you see. That is the quintessential coming together of a whole bunch of talented people.
Good stuff, man. Yeah, I watched the episode, man, and I didn't know what to expect.
And
I said, okay, I'm not sure if this is going to be reality, but they say it's the fakest unreality. But, yeah, it held my attention throughout. It was parts where it's just really just, like, laugh out loud funny. I thought it was a great show. Because I'm going to be honest, man, with all due respect to the network, I don't watch that much stuff on BET. I used to be, in late 80s, early 90s, I was a BET fiend. And then I just, like, start losing. And, like, anybody I know would say, you watching a game? I'm like, hell no, I ain't watching no damn game.
Right.
And but this might be, I think this is going to be the show that brings me back to BET.
Well, that's what we hope, man, that BET, this show will do for BET what The Daily Show did for Comedy Central, what In Living Color did for Fox, what SNL did for NBC back in the day. And, I mean, I know those are big and bold, but those are the kind of that's the kind of thing we want to do. We want to make a bold statement about what can be done when you put talented people in a room, you can really put together a good project. And we're hoping that this will be the beginning of people to see that, and this is when you know, you got something. When in 2 years or 3 years from now, when we have another conversation, I might not be at BET. I'll have my own show going. I'll be somewhere else working because the people that are writing, the people that are producing are able and creating. Chris Spencer was the creator of the show. We got Ralph Farquhar. We got some talented people in the room. I want to mention everybody. Johnny Mack, Wayne Stamps, Calvin Brown, Michelle Brown, Prescott Tuck, Matt, and Robin Thede are all in the room, man. When you see those names again and you see that they're now producing their own shows, creating their own stuff, it means that they believed in the talent in the room and they parlayed that material, they parlayed this job into something else. And that's when you know you're doing good, when you did something good in this business, when you can parlay one job to the next. And that's the way success is measured in this town, is how well you did on your last job and how well it helps you move to the next one. So if in a couple of years, like I said, we're all creating our own shows and you see my name on the top created by Buddy Lewis and I get back to this and say, this is what happened. This is why it happened. And that will be the biggest testament to how well this show's, how successful this show was, is when people who are working on it are able to get more work.
Man, dude, you just dropped some Well, at least for me. I'm over here taking notes, bro.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's true.
That's good stuff. Well, at least for people in the industry now. I don't know. People not in the industry might not be able to relate to what Buddy was breaking down.
And it's especially true for the black people in this town, man, you know, because there are a lot of people that I can tell you right now, it's funny, you know, it's really weird, but half of the writers that were on In Living Color, half of the black ones collected unemployment, but all the white ones got shows. they keep working.
I believe it, and, now I want to tell my listeners, I got a diversity of listeners. So, you know, my listeners know I rarely play,
I'm not playing the race card. I'm just saying, but that's what happens is in this town is that it's a catch 22. You can work on a very popular urban show and this is just the way it is. And I don't know why it is, but a white guy that works on an urban show is considered a guy that can write in both worlds.
Yeah.
A black guy that works on a successful black show is all he can do is write black shows. So it's not that a guy couldn't work on In Living Color and work on Saturday Night Live. I'm sure he could. It's just that's the sort of lane that sometimes people put you in is that all you were able to do is this. But for a guy that's white, it's like, wow, he's really a diverse talent. So it's the old adage, like running quarterbacks, when a black quarterback is athletic, but a running white quarterback is not only athletic, he's smart. You go, man, you know, he's a good quarterback. It's just the way it is, and what you got to do is navigate yourself out of that. And that's why I say, and it's getting better because there's a lot more avenues for people of color, people of women, to present their material, present themselves on the entertainment game. The internet is the great equalizer. You don't need anybody to tell you whether or not you can or cannot put something on the internet. So if you want to get on the internet and put your material out there, submit your material, get a following, that's what you got to do. And so it's not a matter of somebody telling me I cannot do something or I'm only in one area or you got to find your way to get your material out and put it out there. And the internet can do that. And that's why I tell everybody who wants to get in the entertainment game, if you want to get in the entertainment game, you can get in the entertainment game from your house. If you can build a following, you will become a internet magnet. If you're an internet magnet, you can monetize whatever it is you're doing from the confines of your own home.
What's interesting about first of all, before I say what's interesting about that comment, brother, my listeners know I always bring guests on my show. Now, 95% of my shows have to do with just specifically with dating and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I always, the reason why most of my listeners love me is because if I have a guest on my show who I think honestly is full of shit and not really bringing it, I'll call them out on it. Because the reason why I call it upfront and straightforward is because I want people to be frank and candid. So I got to give you a dap and kudos as someone who's worked in the industry, not to the extent that you have, but, man, everything you were saying, man, you just broke some shit down, dog. It was the truth, and I give you props, and I appreciate you keeping it real on my show, because, man, I remember when I used to work at NBC, and I indirectly would work on shows like The Fresh Prince, and every time at the end of the show, man, they would introduce the writers. I want to say not one time was there a black writer.
Right.
And I could not believe that, dude. Believe that.
Yeah, it's rare sometimes, you know, you see a show that's, you know, you see an urban show and, you know, you go, well, who's writing? Who's doing this stuff? And that's why a lot of times comics, especially urban comics, get on shows and you go, oh, man, he's not funny on that show. But it's because there's no one on the show that has that comic's voice in their head. They're all watching what they think is this comic's beat or this vibe. And that's also a problem with the comics as well, that comedy is sort of an individual sport. And so a lot of times comics don't have friends. They don't have people that they cling together and go, hey, man, this guy knows me. So when he finally gets a show, he can say, this guy writes for me, this guy writes for me, this guy writes for me. But see, networks don't really want to hear that. And there's no comic a lot of times has the desire to put up a fight for his friends. You know, like, hey, man, this is the guy that got me here. So why can't you hire him? So, and this guy, whoever this him is, he's got to be ready. When his friend gets ready to get on the TV show, he's got to have his spec script in his hand. So he can go, why should we hire this guy? Well, he helped me, and he's got his own spec script. Bam. But the guy who's the celebrity or the star has got to be able to fight for his friends and believe that, hey, man, if the network or whoever wants you, you can say, hey, man, listen, I'm successful right now because of this guy and this guy. I need them in the room. A lot of comics won't put up a fight for people like that. And that's sometimes how you get people in the business. See, and a lot of times comics and people just forget. Oh, really? You got here by yourself? No, you didn't. I was up at 2 o'clock at night at the comedy club helping you do this material, and we tweaked this joke. And I was on the you forget. And when the deal goes down and the money comes up, sometimes you get amnesia. And so that's why I'm happy. I got friends like Chris Spencer, who no matter where he's gone, where he's gotten to, he's always looked back and helped me out. And I'm trying to do the same for some other people myself, because I didn't get here by myself. You never get in this business in Hollywood. You never get anywhere by yourself. That's why when Chris Rock made the comment about comics not being, the comics aren't as good as they used to be, you know, it really irritated people, you know, because you're like, well, Chris, you know, at the time that you came up, there were a lot of comics that helped you out. You didn't get as funny as you got by yourself. He's got a staff of cool writers, talented dudes that helped him write. So the reason why you think some of these guys aren't as funny is because they don't have a crew of writers. He's got some of the best comedy writers in the business writing for him. And then guys that are talented comics themselves. Louis C.K., Lance Carruthers. He's got a whole bunch of guys that help him write. Neil Brennan. Neil is Dave Chappelle's guy. There are a couple of guys that help Chris write. And so it's just like when Damon and Keenan and all them were together, they helped Eddie write.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. I was just thinking about that as you were talking about this. Because I'll be honest, man, back in the day, I used to think all stand-up comics just, you know, basically wrote and performed their own stuff. And the first time I knew, well, no, this is not the first time, technically, because somebody had told me that Richard Pryor, that Paul Mooney would write some of his stuff.
Yeah, Paul Mooney. There's another guy. Oh, he's going to kill me when he remembers. I can't remember his name. Dave, I forget Dave's last name, man. But Dave and Paul Mooney, and there are a lot of guys that helped Richard Pryor write. Robin Williams. He used to help write. He was on Richard Pryor's show.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's funny, because when Eddie did Raw, I remember it came out that, because, see, I was more familiar with Damon, and to be truthful, I didn't even really know who Keenan was. The first time I want to say I even heard of Keenan was when they were talking about Raw. They said, yeah, Eddie had a team of writers, and they mentioned some of the writers, and one of them was Keenan Ivory Wayans. I was like, oh, I didn't know Damon had a brother that was in the business. And but it's funny, you know, you end up finding out about the guys who end up doing both, like yourself. You do both. You perform and you write. But for those that just write, sometimes, as we start off the conversation, talking about these guys could be in the industry for years, but yet nobody would know who they were because
right. People
in the industry wouldn't know who they are, but the average
right. Person
wouldn't. And I have to admit, again, and this is my final point on the whole race thing,
mm-hmm.
I get a little frustrated. Like, I was reading, in preparation for me wanting to form some questions for you, I was reading a couple of things on the internet about top television writers, and man, it wasn't really not hardly any prominent black people mentioned. Well, the only one was mentioned. I didn't know that speaking of Richard Pryor, Bob Mooney, they used to write for the Sanford and Son. I never knew that until I just read it.
They were writers. Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to know you do it. Oh, now the point I want to touch on, you said nowadays, I remember Time Magazine actually did a cover story about this. It was called doityourself.com, and they were basically saying, and you could say predicting, that with the world of the internet,
mm-hmm. You
won't have to move to a certain city to do certain things. And like you said,
mm-hmm. Nowadays
you can pretty much make it into the industry from your own home just by
yeah. Developing
a following. And one guy, I'm going to throw out his name, and you might have forgot this guy's name, but you were actually on his show, and I got minor beef with you, buddy. You my boy, and I love you to death. But I said, if buddy on anybody's blog talk radio show, it should be my show. But you ended up being a guy though named Jason Barnes. He goes by nickname 6ix9ine.
Oh, man, listen, I met crazy Jason Barnes, man. He called me one day because as a matter of fact, I got on his show originally because Kim Whitley was doing the show, and she asked me to be on sort of with him. And don't be mad that I did his show first. Don't take offense to that, dog. Jason Barnes, as a matter of fact, speaking of parlay, he put me in a little movie he produced. And when you get a movie, I'll keep doing your show. You had a movie role at the end of your show. So,
but yeah, you know what's funny though? Jason, well, I wouldn't say he's got there yet, but I recently gave him press because Jason was a guy, when I first met Jason, he was a friend of a friend of mine on Facebook.
Right.
Didn't know who the dude was. He was just
right. Some
regular brother living in D.C. Then he became a fan of my show.
Right.
Start calling into my show and expressing very strong comments, which I like.
Right.
And next thing I know, he told a mutual friend of mine, he said, I'm going to start my own show.
Right.
So he started his own show on Blog Talk Radio.
Right.
Then he would write these really strong comments against black women. Now, some of it would just cause a lot of controversy and consistency.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Didn't like it, but it was interesting how a lot of sisters are. I'm calling you sisters out who are listening. Sisters, they'll get mad when somebody says something they don't like, but yet they gravitate more to that guy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened with Jason. He started developing a following on Facebook because he would say all these controversial comments about black women. Anyway,
okay. Long
story short, one day he just got in his car and just drove out to L.A. and said, man, I'm about to, you know, make some stuff happen. And at the time, honestly, I was like, yeah, kind of like, yeah, right. But the dude, now he done did a low-budget film. He's either just finished or on the verge of finishing. You said he put
mm-hmm.
you in something. Matter of fact, we just had a discussion a week ago. Matter of fact, he convicted me. He's getting on my case because he's like, Alan, man, I heard you used to write screenplays, man. Why ain't you writing no more? I said, well, you know,
right.
I kind of got away from it. He said, man, what's
mm-hmm.
holding you back, man? He said, like mm-hmm. you, he said, man, you don't need to be in L.A. to write. He said, you can be right wherever you are, man. Just start writing, man. Write a script.
And there are plenty of festivals. You can write your scripts and submit your, shoot it, and send them to a festival. Shoot it and, you know, submit your script. They have screen
They have screenwriting festivals where it's just the writing, and then you listen to the thing, people can read, and then there are like four or five sites online that you register your material first. I always tell everybody, register your material. You can submit your stuff online to Indigo.com and Kickstarter and all these other things and say, listen, I want to raise some money. Read my script. I want to raise some money to do this. People invest in your project. There are a lot of ways to get money and to get things done if you're really determined. And there's nothing stopping anybody now other than lack of desire and lack of time. You just gotta get in there and have some forethought, sit down and get it done. Because there's no reason why people can't come up with the internet. The internet is worldwide. You're not restricted to the U.S. You're not restricted to your state. You're not restricted to your city. You are worldwide on the internet. So you got to use that power.
Yeah.
You got to use it.
Well, I'm going to take one more intermission break. Listeners, if you want to call in and ask my guest a question or make a comment related to tonight's discussion, you can do so by calling 646-478-5710. Again, that's 646-478-5710. And I'm coming in my final segment. I'm gonna get to the juicy questions.
Okay.
I want to ask, because I already talked to my guest tonight briefly earlier. He had a reaction that lets me know this is going to be a juicy talk. What we're going to get into in the next and final segment is I want to just simply ask him, why is it so challenging in general for both men and women, but particularly for men, to stay married while working in the entertainment industry? Hands down, more than any other industry that's associated with divorce, it's the entertainment industry. We're going to talk about that when I get back right after this intermission break. So don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Dangerously, and you may have read my short story, Till Death Do Us Part, in the New York Times best-selling anthology, Succulent, Chocolate Flavor 2, presented by Zane. Well, things get even hotter between the pages of Keep Your Panties Up and Your Skirt Down. Check it out at PantiesUpSkirtDown.com. And remember, keep it dangerous.
What's up, folks? This is Alan Roger Curry of Upfront, Straightforward, and Low One fame. And if you're a music lover, I urge you to listen to Madison Media Radio. It's not just music, but it is music with a purpose. Right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
Low One.
Do you think that guys, to one degree or another, have to play the role of the bad boy to attract women, or they just need to remain who they are and just, you know, be patient?
No, they need to combine their game. They need to go in with an attitude that I'm going to be a gentleman, but I'm also letting you know that I'm attracted to you. You know, I want to kiss you. I want to hold you. I want to, you know, I want to take you out. I want to date you. You know, if you think I want to get in your pants, you're probably right. But at the same time, I like you. I like you. I want to see you.
You know, there's more single women than married women in the United States.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's over 51%. Yeah.
There's more what?
Okay. There's more single women than married women in the United States right now. First time ever in history.
Mindset is correct. Somewhere there's a woman that's balanced, that's God-focused, that's, you know, she gives because she wants to give, not because she's trying to hook somebody with her giving, but she values herself. She recognizes her good qualities, acknowledges her bad qualities, and this is the person that's balanced and ready to be in a healthy relationship.
Thank you.
just so the listeners know, there's a letter in my first book, Letters to a Young Brother Manifest Your Destiny. It's called Finding Your Swagger. In fact, it's so funny. I just got a letter from a young brother that he read my book, and it's changed his life. And he also put it in, he said, and you know what? I found my swagger, and now all the girls like me like you said they would. I was so tickled by that, yeah.
Oh, man, you gotta love it.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
The Real Husbands of Hollywood, only on BET.
We now return to my discussion about the challenge of maintaining a successful marriage while working in the entertainment industry with Roland Buddy Lewis on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, the number one most listened to talk radio podcast program on Blog Talk Radio in the category of romance and dating relationships, even though the last couple weeks kind of gotten away from dating and relationships. Like last week, my show was about health and fitness. So if you went on Blog Talk Radio and looked for my show in romance, you wouldn't have found it because it was in the fitness category. And this show is going to be listed under television. But now we are getting ready to get into dating relationships. Because up to this point, my guest tonight, if you're just tuning in, is a good friend of mine, as well as a successful comedian and feature film, television, and event series comedy writer by the name of Roland Buddy Lewis. Grew up with this guy, love his whole family, just were great people, and he's been holding it down, and tonight, you could say he's been given a teleclass. I could have charged for this. If you're a person who's aspiring to make it in the industry, Buddy has been given a class tonight. So make some notes on this. Brother been breaking some stuff down. But what we're going to get into tonight, this segment is going to be directly related to dating relationship. It's going to start off with just the simple question to my guest. Buddy, why is it so, in your opinion, I'm sure everybody had their own take, their own opinion, but in your opinion, why, compared to other industries that people work in, why is it so hard for people to stay married while working in the entertainment industry?
I think the difficulty with relationships in general in the entertainment industry is the artist's life is very, 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 very different from any other job. So let's take a
a comic. I work at night. My job is to be creative, you know, to come up with jokes, come up with material, come up. I gotta do this. I work at night. Most comedy clubs are at night. I do auditions during the day, so I have to be focused on sides and scripts, and you know, you're doing all this stuff. Well, for a person that's working a 9-to-5 job, they get up and a woman that gets up with a guy who's a comic gets up with a guy. And she goes into a job. She's like, why are you still in bed at 10 o'clock? Well, I was out till 2. Why don't you bring in the same amount of money every week? Well, I don't work like that. You know, I get $50 here, $30 here, $40 here, $50 here. Now, at the end of the week, I might have made $1,000. But I might not make that same $1,000 next week. So over the course of a month, she's got her salary, boom, boom, boom. She's like, why don't we have enough money to pay the bills this month when we had it last month? Well, you know, I didn't make the same amount of money. I didn't get the same gigs. I don't. Everything is not the same. So there's a up and down, and there's peaks and valleys in the artist's life. Until you reach a certain level in the entertainment business, your life has hills and valleys, highs and lows. And for a person that works 9-to-5, it's hard to understand. How do you live like that when you don't know how you're going to pay your bills? Well, that's part of the artist's tension. You know, that's part of being an artist. You got to keep working. So now what ends up happening is, well, you're struggling and you need to get a job. Well, I got a job. My job is in the entertainment business. I ain't a real job. Oh, okay, so now you spitting on my career. You spitting on my career choice. You kicking me in the face telling me I'm not going to make it. So that in itself lends itself to problems that can be in a relationship. Now let's get to artists that are in the same, when you're in the same business, it can be difficult. Because let's look at a woman like Halle Berry. How difficult would it must have been for somebody to watch this woman?
I know where you're going with that.
Dude, you gotta understand. But see, now if you're a real secure dude, like some dudes should have been, this is a perfect opportunity for a woman, like for you to get one up on your woman if they ever do something like that. Because now, how can Halle Berry ever say she doesn't want to have sex? She could never tell me that, because I'd be like, act like you did when you was acting with Billy Bob. Let's get it cracking. Action. Action. Let's get it cracking, boo. I think so. That kind of thing. How do you look at a dude who you know? How does Paulette or you know, how does Angela Jolie look at Brad Pitt when he has all these scenes with these women? It's tough. So you got to be real secure in who you are, and that's why it's difficult. And you're the spouse of a person who's a musician. It's really difficult when you lead a show and there are 400 or 500 people that want autographs. You ready to go? But that's what you got to do. You got to go to the little raggedy ass parties. You got to go. How would it feel to be the wife of a big time celebrity? Who, I mean, how do you think Nicole Ari Parker and Boris have to deal with each other? Two pretty ass people like that. Dude, can you imagine what they go through? How many dudes are lusting after your wife? You turn a corner and it's a dude saying something crazy to your wife, or you turn the corner and it's some girl all up on your man. It was so difficult. So you got to be real secure. That's the first thing. Most people are not secure enough to handle relationships with artists. That's the first thing. I'm not talking about men or women. I'm talking about both.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a certain amount. You have to have a certain level of maturity and a certain level of self-esteem to be in a relationship with an artist. I mean, any kind, music, entertainment, comedy, whatever it is. It's just you got to be secure who you are. And if you're an artist, who's dating an artist. Y'all have to really talk about, you know, the parameters for how you're going to operate with each other. It's just, that's something that has to be done.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, every year there's just a slew of celebrity divorce. I start off in my intro talking about a few of them, like for the most, I guess, most name recognition related one this in last year was Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes. But
I think you know, you can't look at, see, there's a difference between a celebrity relationship, and I think sometimes these let me say this. There's a difference between celebrity marriages and celebrity facades. You don't always know why some of these people get married. You know? It's not always just because we love each other. You know, there are a lot of different parameters for why a lot of these celebrities are married. And it's not always love. That ain't always the first thing.
Well, I would say that's true, yeah, both probably in and out of the entertainment industry, because I've talked about on my show on different subjects I've had. I've had women that I knew that I was personally acquainted with who have told me over the years, they'll say stuff like, "Alan, I knew the day of my wedding that I wasn't in love with my husband." And I'll be like,
yeah.
"What? Why'd you marry him then?" Like one woman, she told me, for example, she said she got married to a guy who she didn't love at all, but he wanted to have kids real bad. So she said, "I'll have kids for you if you take care of me financially for the, you know, next upteen years." So they got married basically because of like a financial arrangement. And I was just like, wow, how can you do that? I don't get that.
Amazing.
But
but you know what? That's not I mean, you know, if that's happening in certain communities, and I mean, that's not as surprising to me as some of the other things I hear. You know, there are a lot of times that people want to protect their images out here. There are a lot of celebrities that want to protect their image for various reasons. You know, whether it's I'm gay, you know, there used to be a time when people would hide that it's not as bad anymore, but there was a thing when people would hide that part of their life. You know, it's not something that most people need to do anymore. But at the time, there were a lot of people, there were a lot of guys that got married to hide, you know, who they were. You know, there were times when people did that sort of thing. It's not necessary anymore, but that was something that happened. I think there are some people that get married for, hey, you know what? You know, he's a big time agent. You know, he can get me a movie. You know, I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but there are a lot of people that get married for convenience. You know, and that happens out here. That happens out here in LA a lot. You'd be shocked how many people are married for convenience. You know, and then you get the old adage. There are a lot of women out here that are like, "Hey, man, I don't care. I just want to have a kid. Clock's ticking. I've done all this. I'm ready to have children." Nah, I knew we weren't gonna make it. I make enough money. I just needed a donor.
Speaking of children, you have children, right?
I have one. She's 18. Hopefully, she'll be off to college somewhere next year, and soon out of my pocket. And I tell this joke on stage, if my wife ain't careful, we're gonna pull up at some college in this town, and she's gonna be like, there's an extra bag in the car. Oh, that's yours. You and her both get out. No, you need an education on learning how to live alone, because I'm out.
Okay, now what, I don't know what her interests are, I'm sure you do, but what if she was to say, Dad, I want to be like you, I want to pursue a career in some capacity in the entertainment industry. Would she have your blessing, or would you be like, oh, hell no, you ain't going in the entertainment industry?
She would have my blessing in the sense that I would try to lead and guide her, but the toughest job in America, and I don't mean to be any way non-blunt or skirt around this, being an African-American actress is the hardest thing in the world. First of all, there aren't that many roles. There aren't that many opportunities for them as it relates to television, TV. If you look at television and TV, you probably see the same 15 or 20 women working on everything. Movies, television, everything. So it's very difficult because we've yet to move to a colorblind society where African-American women are viewed with the same level of beauty, appeal, and everything else as other women. So let's some people would disagree with me, but it's a fact. You go to all these, if you go right now to a magazine rack, you'll see how many black women are face up on fashion magazines right now. How many times in the history of the swimsuit issue has there been a black woman on the Sports Illustrated issue?
Good
Let me give you a prime example. A guy who's the quarterback of, I think, Texas A&M, they just showed his girlfriend on TV. Brent Musburger made a comment about this girl. Now all of a sudden she's a correspondent at the Super Bowl.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
He stammered his story about how beautiful this girl was, and now all of a sudden they're like, you're damn right she is. Let's put her on TV. Now they don't know where, I don't know what this girl's background is. She might be a television superstar, celebrity, whatever. She might be that, being a quarterback's girlfriend. She might be a model. She might be a spokeswoman. She might be in communications at school. But that level of attention that got drawn to this woman put her on the next level. I'm sure there's a brother. Well, I don't know if there are any brothers with black women that play football. That might be tough. They're not many brothers that play sports that have black girlfriends. But let me just say, there might have been one.
You keeping it real, buddy, man.
They had a girl who was fun enough for the same thing to happen, but I don't believe she would have got to look at the beauty of the sister sitting there. You wouldn't get that. There goes Jamal's girl. Yeah. There's Taquan's girlfriend, Maria. She's great for supporting her man. That's about all the shit you'll get. You don't get the raven stammering how gorgeous and all that. You don't get that. So what I'm saying is it can be difficult for a sister in the business. Now, that going back to what my daughter wants, I would be able to help my daughter navigate a little bit better than a lot of other times in history and in period, because what Hollywood is about, and most people don't understand this, it's about networking relationships. It's not necessarily how talented you are. It's about who you know in a position that can help you move forward. And because I'm in the industry, my daughter will have a upper hand on anybody else who's in the who's coming from another place to get into the business. Because not only do I work, I have a network that's 20 years old of people that have jobs, that are creating jobs, that are creating opportunities, that know about opportunities. I've been in front of half the casting directors in town. So I'll know, hey, listen, go talk to so-and-so and so-and-so. Hey, they got a movie with a role that might fit you, blah, blah, blah. Go see so-and-so. Let me call Mick McCall and let me get you in. I can do that. That's different than somebody coming from East Jablip who's out here for the first time. They need an agent to know about some of this stuff that I'm already going to hear about. You know why I heard about it? Because my friend wrote it. Because my friend who's a casting director is casting it. So, and this is the first generation of, I would say, probably maybe 10, 15 years ago, this next generation of children, my kids, will be the first generation of kids that will have people that are deeply entrenched in the entertainment business that are African American. And I'm going back 20 years, you look at, there are a lot of black executives now in positions of power. There are a lot of entertainers who have kids. There are a lot of people that have children. So when my daughter is able to come back and say, I want to be in the entertainment business, she will have an upper hand on a lot of other people because of the network that's been created prior to her getting here. And my network, she'll be able to tap into my network of friends, my network of alliances, my network of associates. So it's going to be easier for her than it would be for someone else. Do I want her in the business? No. I personally don't think most people, most women especially, don't know how tough it is to be an actress. They don't have a clue. First of all, many of them do not have the amount of self-esteem and or level of handling rejection to be in this business. How difficult is it for a girl who's from Davenport, Iowa, who's probably Tinkletown, Nebraska, to come out to Hollywood and everybody says, you are the it. You're the next Gabrielle Union. You're the next Halle Berry, baby, here in Tinseltown, Utah, whatever. You think you're the bomb. And you walk into a room, and there are 25 women that look just like you.
Yep.
I can't tell you how you see the look on women's face when they come out here like, damn. Yeah. There are 25 women that all got called in for. We had a woman between the ages of 20 and 25, model-esque. That breakdown, you walk into a room and there's 25 women that look just like you. Better looking. Some are better looking than you. Better bodies, everything. Now, who's going to get the job? Because everybody can read them two lines. Everybody can read those two lines. It doesn't take much acting skill to read them two lines. A lot of times, if I'm just throwing everybody. It's like being at the combine. At some point, all of those people can play football at the combine. Who's gonna stand out? Well,
that's a good analogy.
There are going to be some standouts. Everybody who ran a 4.4, every wide receiver that runs a 4.4 40 is like, oh, that's pretty good. All right, What's going to make this person stand out? Oh, let's start talking about character. Let's start talking about your bench press. Well, in the world of acting, what other things help? Oh, look at your resume. Oh, okay, you've worked with blank and blank and blank and blank and blank and so and so. Oh, okay, cool. I mean, I know those people. Let me call them and see what you're about. How was this person to work with? Oh, they were great. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, you got a good 40 time, or you're pretty. You can read the lines. You've worked with some people I know. Let's send this person in for a producer session. Because once they narrow that 25 girls down to maybe four, then it's a call. Now it's a call for really, okay, for four or five people. Let's see who's going to get the job. Well, once you get to the producer session, I guarantee you, if there's four people in the room, three of them already worked with a writer, a director, a producer. Somebody in the room already knows that person. Now, who's going to get the job when you're up against the director's friend's daughter? Who's going to get the job? Well, we like the girl who, we like Buddy's daughter. Nah, you know what? But I know this girl. I've known her since she was 8. That's my goddaughter. Just give her the job. That's going to happen. I don't give a damn how well you read. Because after a while, it gets to stuff that you don't even know why you don't get jobs. This is the only entertainment. The entertainment business is almost the only business in the world where you never really find out why you didn't get it. You go to the mill, when you're a mechanic, you know why your ass didn't get it. Your ass can't work on Camrys. You're not good with the freaking metric system, so I can't let you in my tool room when you can't read tools. You mismeasured some stuff. You know why you don't get a job as a carpenter. But when
that's so true,
LA, dude, and like I said earlier, man, what happens is, a lot of stuff, okay, this girl is too tall for the star. This girl she looks like somebody else in the show a little bit. Let's take the darker version of her. Oh, man, you know what? This girl has a mole on her face, and our girl who's in the celebrity in the scene where they have a mole, we don't want two girls with moles on their face. I'm telling you, it gets down to crazy shit.
Wow, man, that's I mean, well, I know from working in the industry, this doesn't totally surprise me, but I'm sure a lot of my listeners are like, wow, that's crazy.
It's crazy, but you got to eliminate people. You got to eliminate people for something because there are four people in there. Four people can't do the job.
Yeah.
So how do you eliminate? Or how do you choose a person? What other criteria do you use to make your decision on who can do this job the best? Some people just naturally have a talent. They just blow the room away with their talent. That happens. I'm not saying that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you, if there are two lines, it's two lines. Dude, I went in for a role, and the line was, that was the line.
The line was what?
Oh! Who can do that shit? Who can't do that? It's 15 dudes out in the... we all out there. How can I be different? That's my motivation. Get out of here, dude. Just read this. Come on, man. Commercials, you don't know why you don't know what they want in a commercial. I've been in commercial auditions where it'll be 30, 40 dudes out there. They don't know what they want. Well, when we put together, we need a guy that can, the director wants a guy that's, we have this background. He's too tall. He's too big. He's too wide. It's all kind of, you never know. Commercial auditions are the worst. You have no clue. Because sometimes there's no dialogue in a commercial. So there's nothing to read.
Yeah, that's true.
So I say all that to say, a lot of people don't have what it takes to be in the business. And sadly, for African-American women and for women in general, here's the next problem that they have. And I'm not holding any punches. Everybody wants to sleep with them if you're cute. Listen, ladies, if you want to be an actress, I guarantee you, with 100% certainty, there's going to be some producer, some writer, some other actor that's going to want to sleep with you for a role. Now, how are you going to respond to that? Now, and here's the problem, again, going back to relationships. You're a dude dating an actress. How desperate is she for a role? I used to say this on stage. All you women in here that want to be actresses, y'all are one sex romp away from being a celebrity.
That's one of those that is funny because it's funny, but it's funny because it's true.
Dude, so what? Your girl gonna give Spike Lee some head to get in this movie? How desperate is she to pay her rent? See, and a lot of people don't think about that. They come out here, Alan, and they have it, and these girls, a lot of them don't have no plan. They don't have no skills. I mean, damn, you can't type, you can't do nothing. You can't do nothing. So you're a waitress. That used to be the biggest gag, that used to be the biggest joke in the country. I'm an actress in L.A. Okay, where do you wait tables? That was the next question. Where are you waiting? What restaurant you work in?
Man, quick story, buddy. Man, when I lived in L.A., man, when I first moved out there, my listeners know I won't even hold back. I was struggling my ass off, and.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a job thinking that, you know, when you're desperate for a job, desperate for money, you think of what you think of as the quote-unquote easy jobs, jobs that, you know,
right,
ain't going to require much experience, credentials,
right,
et cetera. So I thought a waiter would be an easy job, only to find out I had like 2 to 3 interviews, man. Man, and listeners in Los Angeles, and maybe it's like this in New York and other big cities, they take waiting seriously. Like, I thought I was being interviewed for, like, Microsoft or something. Because the guy was like, okay, where do you have experience waiting? I was like, well, actually, I don't really have any. He's like, Then he started naming these technical terms that I guess, you know, waiters, things they need to know to do. Like, he said it's a serious talent to be able to carry a tray, like, on one hand,
right,
and balance it.
Exactly.
And he was basically like, he told me, he said, if you don't have that experience, he said, I can't hire you. And
dude,
I was like, wow. I said, y'all can't just like teach me? And he was like, no.
Ain't got time to teach you when there's another actor out here who's already acting like they know how to be a waiter? Trust me, dude. Waiting tables, dude. And see, everybody out here in L.A., this is the next thing. Everybody out here in L.A. Everybody has a side deal. Everybody in here has something else they do. Yeah, well, you know, I'm an actor, but right now I'm working in Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Man, you're an Enterprise worker. You ain't no actor. I'm a mailman, but I write scripts. You ain't a script writer, you're a mailman. So, dude, a lot of these people out here, their hobby is entertainment, some form of entertainment. And those that are going to make it are the people that break through and they put their plan in order and they got their stuff straight.
Real quick, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but EVP, I see the hand wave on my audio board. Do you have a question or comment you want to add in this conversation?
Yes, I do. Shout out to to Buddy, man. I was just hoping to give him a little breath of some air there, man. He was going on such a rapid fire there for a while. I was just
give Buddy
a break there, man. But man, I'm still laughing about that. How you brought that back about how the women better be ready to sleep with somebody to get in the bed.
That was one romp away.
I was like, and I can see that coming back up sometime later in the future on Upfront. Straightforward. Now, that's just too hard.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm going to use that because that's the truth.
A question I have for Buddy was a little bit off the directly tied to relationship, but just a question I had that, if at all, how would you say, and personally, I guess, is the way I guess it would relate it to you in terms of getting into the business, how much of it all has helped you coming in from a comedic versus, say, straight on like an actor and dealing with the rejection and so forth, you know, because I see being able to probably humorize and put things in when you ran into difficulty. Rejection and roadblocks and things like that. If at all, that helped you deal, cope with it better.
Well, I think there are two things that helped me. I consider it versatility is one of the things that I think makes people out here succeed. If you're able to do a little bit more, if you're not just an actor, if you can write, if you're not just you look at a lot of actors, they start learning how to direct. You look at comics that are comics, they want to learn how to act. You look at musicians that want to act. If you have some versatility, that helps. I believe right now you should be sort of well rounded in all areas and be because that's the only way you can continue to work. Now I can go do stand up. I can go act. I can do voiceovers. I can do warm up. I can go to the theater. There are a lot of areas of the entertainment business that I'm able to manipulate and move in because I consider myself a little bit more versatile than some people. As a coping mechanism, yes. I mean, every comic is using everything around him, the stress, the ups, the downs. I use all of that to find material. And so if I can't do it on stage, maybe I can put it in a script. If a story isn't popping off the way I want it to on stage, but it makes a better movie idea or a better sketch idea, you got to use that. You write it down and you use it. And that's what I've done. That's my process.
Awesome. Awesome. And I applaud you, too, as well as Alan's done a few times on the show. Perseverance definitely shown through. Quite proud of you. Keep on keeping on, man. Keep me laughing.
I do that. Thank you, my brother.
All right, EVP, that's Irvin V. Pulliam, another Gary, Indiana product that listens to my show. Regularly. I don't know, buddy. You might remember his younger sister, Stephanie Pulliam.
Yeah, I remember Stephanie used to be out here for a while. We used to run into each other. I don't see her anymore. I don't know if she's still out here. I think she was married to a basketball player,
Winston Garland. Yeah. But,
And I forgot about Michael. What was Mike's last name? Guys from Gary. He's a comic, man. Not Mike.
Oh, Michael Tillerson.
Michael Tillerson. I haven't seen him in ages, man. But he was out here for a while doing his thing.
Yeah, he's now a college professor. He went
Is
back
he
to
really?
School and got his PhD. And last I heard, his mother told me he was he's a college professor for one of the state of New York, what they call SUNY. State University of New York campuses.
Wow, that's amazing! Because me and Mike got into it. I loaned him my car, and he lived all the way down in San Diego. And I was like, man, we gonna bring my car back. And he was working as a comic. He was working at this little, as a waiter, a bartender. He was working at this club, and it was so funny. Mike might not want me to tell this story, but Michael had been out here, and he had done some TV. He had been out here for a while. I had just gotten to town. And so Mike was like, buddy, he was giving me all this advice and telling me stuff. I'm like, man, because I was tired of people telling me I couldn't work in rooms. So I was the kind of guy that if you wouldn't put me up, like I couldn't get me up in the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory, some of these bigger mainstream clubs, I couldn't get in them because I had to do the amateur nights and all that kind of stuff. I got pissed off. So I started my own room. So I started my own comedy night.
Wow.
And so I must have started 10 of them all over town where, I'd get a bar and I'd be like, yo, man, y'all do comedy in here? And you're like, no. Well, how about we do it on Tuesdays? And then I had this thing called, I used to work downtown when I first got here because that was my plan. I was going to work for a few years and then get myself together. See, I wasn't really a comic. I was a Conica the Fast Boy. I was working in a couple of law firms as the copy dude and I was doing all that stuff. And I started this thing called Happy Hour Comedy, the Happy Hour Comedy Show. And I was downtown and I had this little theater. And Michael came up, and Michael had been here, so he was a veteran to me. I thought Mike was a vet. And, man, Mike came in there, and, I'm not saying I was good, but I had a certain thing because I'd been working down there at the Comedy Act Theater. I'd been working play. I was getting my groove on.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Michael came in there and didn't realize, dude, I got guys that are getting seasoned,
Mm-hmm.
And poor Michael came in that club. And, man, I had all these, there was executives, and lawyers and people that would come down to this club. And before they went home, they would stop in there. I called it Beat the Traffic Comedy something or other. And you would sit there from 6, because I got off of work. I got off work, and from 5 to, 7, we had happy hour and comedy. Dude. Michael came in there, and when I tell you, he died the death of a million high cats.
Oh, God.
And I was like, man, you're getting booked all over town. And I was like,
Wow.
And Michael looked at me, and he was like, dude. He's like, yo, man, you funny, man. Your boys are down here. So I was like, Mike, what are you doing? You're funny, dude. And he did a joke. I never forget that. I was like, looking at him like, what? I'm like, I'm a young comic, but I know better. He did a wash your ass joke. You need to wash your ass. I'm like, are you doing Old Red Fox up in here? I was like, Mike, come on, man. I thought he was messing around. I was like, you can't be serious. And Mike died the death of a hot cat. And every time I invite him to the room, he's like, nah, man, I don't like doing your roles. He's like, because he thought my roles were too urban.
I want to tell a story, but I don't want to feel like I'm ragging on Mike. But, I think all of us learn what we're made to do, and I think we need to experience sometimes something like that to know that this one. But this indirectly involves you. I don't know if you remember, but Mike wanted to have this comedy night in Gary where it was going to be. I was going to be the opening act. You were going to be the middle act, and he was going to be the headliner.
Baby.
And I think you were interested in coming for a minute, but then something came up, and you were like, I just can't make the trip.
Right.
So it ended up being me and Mike at the Genesis Center. That's the only time when I was doing comedy I performed in Gary.
I did a New Year's gig, and everybody used to book Mike like he was the hottest thing since Fish Grease. I came back for New Year's. I remember one time I did a show with him. I was like, dude, go on up there and fire that high five you want. But go ahead, take off.
But, you know, yeah, so what happened, I did my opening act in one room. I wasn't like, they have like the main room and it just,
right.
We were initially in this other room where I invited a lot of family and friends. And and I will say my performance went well, even though I didn't perform that long. I only performed like probably like 15, 20 minutes.
Right.
And so that went well. And then Mike started doing his thing in that room, and he told a couple of jokes that were pretty funny.
Right.
But then he let his ambition get the best of him, because that same night, they were having a Frable Roosevelt reunion in the next room.
Not Frable.
And you know, only people from Gary be able to relate to this. So listen, I'm sorry if you won't be able to relate to this. But in Gary, yeah, it's a Frable Roosevelt reunion is like a big deal. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And so there were like hundreds, if not thousands, of people in that room. So Mike talked to the heads that be at the Genesis Center to moving into that next room. And my little voice said, I said, Mike, dude, I think we should just stay in this room. He said, no, there's more people in there, and I want them. Anyway, long story short, and I say this with all due respect to Mike, two things are wrong. He thought his celebrity in Gary was bigger than what it was. He thought people were literally going to stop and say, hey, you know, that's Mike T. And it wasn't like that. And then he got on stage, man, and his material, just sad to say, it's probably similar to what you experienced in the story you just told. Man, it was so bad, dude, that he literally, and I'm not saying this to criticize, I actually felt bad for him, but he literally started crying, man. We had to, like, walk him, escort him off the stage, man. It was so traumatizing to him, he literally started crying on the stage, dude. And I was like, wow, I just felt bad.
Hey, I crashed and burned, dog. I'm going to tell you, you know what? You're not a comic. Any comic that tells you that they've never bombed or had a bad set, any comic that tells you that is one of two things. Either he hasn't been doing comedy that long, or he's a liar.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
You're going to have one of those nights. And it's just, it's inevitable. The comedy game, everybody has one of those nights where the audience, you were disconnected. It's not your fault. You were just disconnected from the audience. They was not feeling what you was bringing. It happens. I've been there. And sometimes it's for a lot of different reasons. I got booed off of the Comedy X stage. Robin Harris has been chilling one night, man. And Robin put me up. Because he used to do this. He was like, all right, this next guy ain't no good. You don't know him. He ain't never been nowhere. He ain't never done nothing. Bunny Lewis, he put me up on stage. Dude, when I tell you, they turned that spotlight off, and I was like, I'm still talking. I don't need no microphone. The dude came and pulled the microphone out the wall and pulled the cord out of my, dude, when I came in embarrassing. Oh, God.
Oh, man.
I tell you, the most embarrassing story, most humiliating story I ever have in a comedy game, this was probably 15 years ago. I'm in Atlanta. And Jimmy Spott, he'll probably tell this story one day if you ask him. But this is a true story. Jimmy Spott was my opening act.
What?
Jimmy Spott was opening for me. He had just started doing comedy. Now, Jimmy was funny. When I tell you he was funny, Jimmy was hilarious. Jimmy went down to Atlanta where a guy named Michael Williams, who owned the Comedy Act Theater out here in Los Angeles, had another club in Atlanta.
I remember that. Yeah.
And Jimmy was my opening act. This night I was performing there. Now, Jimmy was supposed to do 15, 20 minutes max. But Jamie had been down there in Atlanta where Michael let him just rattle on and on and on. He could do whatever he wanted because he was probably one of the most talented guys in Atlanta at the time. This was before Chris Tucker. This was before Andre Jay. All them guys that came out of Atlanta. Jamie came from L.A. and went down there and was really chilling. So I come down there. I'm booked as the headline act. I go down there. They have shows at 8, 10, and midnight.
Wow.
So the first show, Jamie does it 20 minutes. I do my show. I do good. Jamie does the next show at 10. I'm like, Jamie does like 40 minutes. I'm like, Jamie, you can't do that. You know, and I'm struggling to follow this fool. Because when I tell you this fool had material that was bring you up out your seat, stand up, and clap funny.
Wow.
The next show, I don't know what went into Jamie. I don't know what Jamie got into. I don't know what he did. He did like 45 minutes as the opening act. At the show was first started at 12. It starts at 12:30 or 12:45. By the time I'm going on stage, it's almost 3 in the morning.
Wow.
When I tell you those Negroes in Atlanta was looking at me like, first of all, what you need to do is take your ass back to wherever you came from. I tell you, I was dying the death of a million hot cats. And I felt like, and I wanted to blame Jamie for the amount of time he did. And I wanted, you know, and for, I just hadn't connected. And that late at night, I hadn't really had enough experience to deal with that type of material. I hadn't had enough experience to deal with the crowd. So Jamie ate my, I ate it. Ate it.
Wow. You know, matter of fact, I don't know if you were on the line before I introduced you. I was talking about this whole Monty Tail story, the linebacker from Notre Dame story.
Yeah, maybe I've been following it.
And I was saying that, I said, Tail is experiencing most human beings' worst fear, which is public humiliation. And I remember reading this survey that said if there's at least one thing that most human beings are scared of more than death is, number one, public speaking, and more specifically, being humiliated while doing something related to public speaking. And I remember, I never forget, I was watching Arsenio Hall show, and what's the guy's name? John Sally was on there. And Arsenio was asking him questions about the NBA and stuff. But then he said, John, I heard you been trying your hand at comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And John said something I'll never forget. He said, I'm going to tell y'all something, man. People ask me about being a professional athlete, professional basketball player, and how does it feel, and how challenging is it, and how tough is it to lose, particularly in the playoffs. He said, man, ain't nothing I experienced as a basketball player can compare to being a comic. He said, man, I give mad props to all you comics, anybody who's in the comic. He said, man, because he basically told a brief story of him, as you call it, dying. What's the line you use? I like that line.
Dying the death of a million hot cats.
Yeah. He said his version of that. He said, man, he said that was the worst feeling. He said that felt worse than any playoff loss in his NBA career.
Yep. It's tough. Let me tell you, and the tougher thing is not necessarily that show. It's the one it's the second one. Well, you got to get up and do it again. And you got to find a way. The only way I can describe it is it's like being a football player and fumbling in the end zone and lose the playoffs. You got to gain some manhood and some strength and say, you know what, I'm going to do this again. Because Otherwise, otherwise, this business is not for you. It's not for you. Because the amount of rejection that you have to go through on a regular basis can be difficult. Like I said, you don't know why you don't get jobs. You don't know why you... The same material you told at another club, I'm telling you, I've gone from club to club on the same night, and material that worked in one spot didn't work in another. You know, so if you're not willing to... And you're up in front of people, and you're publicly giving of yourself. It's like you go up there and you really are going to be a professional comic. You got to get up there and really say, you know what, I'm going to get butt naked in front of these people, and I don't care what they say. And if you're not willing to do that, this business is not for you. And that's why you see a lot of comics, man. It takes time. To develop what kind of comic you're going to be. Are you going to be a guy that can self-deprecate? You know, are you going to be a guy that can talk about himself and openly talk about the stuff in your past? That's why Richard Pryor was so great. I mean, he talked about stuff that was so painful that you go, oh, my God, all I can do is laugh at this. He talked about his living in a whorehouse and growing up in Peoria and being poor. If you can't open yourself up to that kind of stuff, sometimes a lot of comics don't want to open themselves up to that kind of self-examination and self-criticism that you grew up in a bad situation. That's why Mike Epps is so deep. People don't realize how Mike Epps is one of the deepest comics right now because he can talk about the pain of growing up in the projects and stuff that, you know, you go, yeah, I heard about that. But he makes it funny. That's why Kevin Hart is funny. He talks about his drunk father and you know, his father was on drugs and you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, the crazy uncles, people in jail in his family. If you can make people get into those stories and you can self-deprecate like that, it allows people to connect with you on a different level. It's really hard because you imagine throwing them kind of stories out and people ain't buying it.
True.
So I mean that's why I admire a lot of comics that have the ability to talk about things that are difficult. You know, people that can open themselves up and open their lives up and talk about the pain. I love those kind of comics. Yeah, and you know, I'm a fan of comedy, man. You know, whether or not you're a prop comic like Carrot Top, or you're, you know, a set up punchline guy like Jerry Seinfeld, whatever type of comedy there is, I enjoy it. And so, but the guys I like are the guys that can really open up and tell their story. Now, I love seeing open pain on stage. I love it. Louis C.K., you know, Dave Chappelle. Man, those guys are really funny to me. Louis Black, guys that can really, Sam Kinison, guys that can really talk about their pain and talk about their stories. That's what I like, you know.
Good stuff, man. Well, we're running out of time, but man, this has been such a entertaining, informative, enlightening conversation. I almost don't want it to end.
Well, invite me back, man.
I'm going to have you back, bro. Yeah, for sure, man, because, like I said, man, you just was breaking it down. Matter of fact, I got some flattering news for you. These aren't my final numbers, but I'm looking at my preliminary numbers. This is my most listened to show by a live audience for the 2012-2013 season so far.
What?
Yeah, you beat out this chick I interviewed, this top female dating coach from London. last fall, she held my record for this season for most live listeners. But, I was just looking at the numbers as you were talking, and you've beaten her out. So,
I'm going to tell you something, Alan. First of all, I don't know any woman dating in London. That was going to be kind of hard to understand anything she said. I mean, the bad teeth and all of that in Europe. I mean, if she's a guru in London, she should really first explain how you get past the dental work. If she can figure that out. Because I'm telling you, them people in England, for having dental care or, having a health care and all that kind of stuff already set for them, there's no reason why all them teeth should be that terribly bad. The smile should be that jacked up.
Now, see, you go out my London listeners, they're going to be like, now, mate, who is that Buddy Lewis? Because I got actually a lot of fans from London.
Hey, you can tell all them Piccadilly people, I said, what's up? Get your tooth fixed. I would say the same thing if we were in the South. If you got listeners in Mississippi, same thing. How you going to have four teeth, two in your mouth, and two in your pocket? This don't make no sense. And then be mad because President Obama wanted to give you health care. You lost your mind. Some of them people should be the first one in line for some Obamacare. But first, if there's dental care attached to it, go on in and get it. You need to get that cracking. Get it cracking. Because your crowns are cracked. Hey, see how they do the dental work in this country? See about the little girl that went and had all the teeth capped with silver? They had her looking like Two Chains. She looked like Lil Weezy. Oh my God! Had not Death Row. What's the record company down there in Louisiana? She was there. I was like, oh my God, she don't know limit. Look at her teeth. She's a no limit soldier. Maybe 8 years old with cavities and dental work, full of silver. Mouth looked like she was chewing on a bumper. It chromed out, dog. She was, I was like, oh my goodness. In Two Chains.
Oh.
It was awful. So, get your dental work fixed. That's all I'm saying. That's it.
Hey, buddy, real quick before I let you go, find two things. Let my listening audience know where they can find more about you on the internet. And then secondly, let them know where they can, when they can watch the next episode of Real Husbands of Hollywood.
Okay, first I'm on Black Bodies in Motion. No, I'm kidding. I'm just Black Tail 2013. RoysOfSteel.com. My website is BuddyLewisComedy.com. Please go there and let me know you heard a little something, something. I'm on Facebook. Also, my Twitter handle is BuddyLewisHUQ84. That's BuddyLewisHUQ84. My website again is BuddyLewisComedy. Please go there and leave something. .com, BuddyLewisComedy.com. The next episode of Real Husbands of Hollywood, the show is going to air every Tuesday, 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Each cable sort of network and has like a different programming schedule as you cross time zones. Like, that we might catch the East Coast feed in California, so that means it comes on at 7, but DirecTV and Dish might only play the West Coast feed at 10. So you got to kind of check your local listings, but it's 10 o'clock, and then there's separate airings during the week. I think everyone in this country should get a DVR or TiVo or something so you can watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it. But just know that the show comes on, and I'm going to say it comes on somewhere in your local time zone between 7 and 10. On Tuesday night, BET. And I don't know, each cable listing has a different sort of, you know, has a different channel, but I know on DirecTV, which I'm on, it's channel 3, I think it's 329 on BET, HD, the BDHD on Tuesdays at 9. So I just, amen, to all the people that watched the show and made this show a big hit, we really, really appreciate it. All the fans checking the show out. Also, my episode, which will air in about the one I wrote, it's called It's Hot in Here, will be in about another 3 or 4 weeks. So I hope everyone will tune in and watch that episode and let me know what you think.
I will be certain to watch that episode. Listeners, please watch that episode and go to Buddy's website, give him some feedback. Brother,
yes.
Much love
and
respect.
I got a couple other things. Can I say one last thing? Okay, I'm sorry. I just want to plug, man. I also have two sitcoms running on the Gospel Network, man. I have a piece called For Richer, For Poor, which is me, Rockman Dunbar, Latoya Luckett, Carl Payne. It's on For Richer, For Poor. It's on the Gospel Music Channel. And also I have another piece coming out with J.D. Lawrence on the Gospel Channel, which is called Community Service. So it's two sitcoms that are running on that network, so I hope you'll check that out as well.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, continued success to you, my friend.
Yes, my brother.
Next time
home,
I come
boy.
Out there, man, we're going to have to hook up and connect for dinner or something.
Let's do it, man. When are you in? Are you still in town, man? Where are you now, man? What are you doing?
Oh, I'm back. GI, man, but I was just out in L.A. I usually come to L.A. like 2 or 3 times a year.
Okay,
so
listen, next time you come to L.A., I got a couple of little spots we can go break some bread, have a drink, and have a nice evening, man. So call me when next time you come to L.A., and I will hit you if I come to GI, which probably won't be anytime soon unless I get my – I got to replace my flag jacket. I lost it out here. And I be careful when I'm in GI. People know me. They'll be like, hey, he's working on that Husband show. Maybe we can get some jewelry or something. Maybe he can, you know, let's shoot him for some Kevin Hart tickets or something. I'm not trying to go out like that.
Oh, man, you silly.
I love them, man. I love my hometown. I always pride my hometown. I don't care what you say. GI was one of the best places to grow up. And happy birthday. Shout out to my mom, man. 82 good ones, man. She's doing her thing down there in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh, man. Yeah, man. For sure, man. Tell your mom and your baby sister that I said, man, I used to just love you because. Man, your mom was such a sweetheart, man, and I remember her and my mother used to have a lot of good conversations.
Yeah, they
back
had
in
great
the day.
Conversations. Your mom was great, man. Your mom was great. Love your mom.
Appreciate you saying that, brother. All right, listeners, this has been Rolling Buddy Lewis. Again, check out his site, Buddy Lewis Comedy. Check out the show he's writing on, Real Husbands of Hollywood. I will see you next week. Right here on Blog Talk Radio. Take care. Have a safe and enjoyable weekend. And